Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Stanford University researchers have developed a blood test that predicts a pregnant woman's due date and might identify women who are at risk of giving birth prematurely. The test isn't ready for general use, and the sample size was small, but early results were promising. New York Times health and science writer Pam Bellick recently covered the issue. She joins us by phone. Welcome to the show, Pam.
Happy to be here, Ann.
And listeners, we'd like to know if a blood test like this would have helped you and your family. Call or email us with any questions, 614-292-8513. My doctor picked my due date, and he was right on the money. What classifies as premature birth these days?
Well, basically anything before, I would say, 35 weeks can be considered premature. You know, they doctors tend to divide that bracket in two. So the closer you are to, say, 36 weeks and later, the closer you are to having a term delivery without issues. But the really, really premature babies are 27 weeks and earlier, sometimes now as early as 23, 22 weeks, but that's very, very, very early.
My recollection is the risks to an early term infant has always been primarily the lungs. Is that still the case?
Yes, I think so. Certainly in terms of survival, but, there's also potential brain damage, neurological damage that can occur the earlier that a baby's born. And heart risks as well. So there are a lot of risks.
Has premature birth been an ongoing issue and the rates of premature birth pretty steady? Or has there been some change in that?
Well, that's a good question. I think that one thing that's happening is that doctors have been increasingly able to deliver babies alive earlier and earlier, stopping at 22 weeks, and that's really only with a tremendous amount of intervention, and only a very few are able to be born, and survive that early. But medical technology, just as it has with everything else, has made it, possible for these very early ones to survive. There are certainly risk factors to delivering prematurely, and some of those have increased, and they're the things that put pregnancies at risk for other reasons too, like overweight,
smoking,
mm-hmm. and diabetes and things like that. So to the extent that those issues have increased, and they have, some women are at greater risk for premature birth. But for a lot of pregnancies that end up delivering prematurely, doctors really don't know why. Some of them just don't. They don't see it. They don't see it coming. It seems like things are progressing in a healthy way, and then something happens and it's time to get the baby out. So being able to identify this and predict it more than we can now would be really a pretty huge thing, because neonatal deaths from premature birth, that's the highest cause of newborn death in the United States.
We're talking about premature births and a study that is getting a lot of attention right now that can predict birth time, birth day. My guest is Pam Bellick. She's a health and science writer for the New York Times. Is there any one group disproportionately impacted by premature birth? Are the demographics playing a role in it at all?
Certainly people who don't have good access to prenatal care are considered more at risk. So it does, have an effect that skews to people who have don't have the resources or don't have the access mm-hmm. to getting good prenatal care.
So tell us about the study. What did they find?
Yeah, so this was a really interesting, and I'm so glad that you mentioned in your intro that it's you know, very preliminary, because mm-hmm. it is, and people shouldn't expect to, you know, be able to go out and buy this blood test, you know, anytime soon. But it was very interesting, in part because the lead researcher is the scientist Stephen Quake, who is really a very well-respected pioneer in the field of genetic blood testing, and he developed the first blood test that can be used to decode whether a baby, you know, whether a fetus is carrying is going to be born with Down syndrome.
Oh, okay.
So, so previously, and still, you know, that's determined by amniocentesis or CVS, and these are, you know, common procedures, but not everybody gets them. They're usually done more for older women over 35. So insurance might not pay for them, and they are invasive. They carry a small but a real risk of increasing miscarriage. So if you can tell with a blood test that there's some genetic risk to your baby, then that's useful information to know. So he was a pioneer in that field, and there have been a number of companies that have made similar tests and an increasing range of genetic conditions that we can check for that way. So that's his background. And what he did here with this team, it was an international team, was instead of checking for DNA, they used a blood test that could measure free-floating RNA in a mother's bloodstream. And so RNA, one way to think about it, is that DNA is, you know, kind of the genetic information in a cell. RNA is kind of the messenger. It's the thing that sort of communicates to other cells, here's what's going on. And so this team thought that if they could, in a very sort of regular way, in this case they did it week by week with 31 women in Denmark who bravely agreed to give blood samples every week during their pregnancy, and they monitored the changes in the RNA, and they traced which genes in the fetal liver, in the placenta, and in the mother's immune system, and those were the three areas that they looked at. They tried to find genes that seemed to be most responsible for these changes in RNA that were making kind of marking milestones during the pregnancy, because obviously during pregnancy things are going to be changing mm-hmm. as the fetus develops, as hormones kick in, all sorts of things happen, you know, through the course of that 9 months. And so they were able to narrow it down to 9 genes that seemed to be the most important in sending out these RNA signals. And when they sort of matched, they sort of what they called a molecular clock, and then they were able to use that clock and what they saw and the changes that they saw over time to basically predict when these women would give birth. And these were all term pregnancies, healthy pregnancies that were done in the initial study. And they found that their prediction using this blood test was as good as ultrasound, which is the other kind of way that a doctor will use now to say, okay, I think you're going to deliver on September 14th. And ultrasound is accurate about half the time, and it only really works in the first trimester. This blood test was accurate about half the time, a little less than half the time. It seems to work best in the second and third trimester, maybe because there's just like more signal. Mm-hmm. They're not entirely sure. But it's promising because it's just another way to be able to sort of pinpoint potentially more accurately when a baby will be born. And it's much, much less expensive, right? An ultrasound costs hundreds of thousands of dollars. A blood test, Dr. Quake told me, could be $10 a pop.
It could be $10 a pop, but are they envisioning that it would be several times over the course of a pregnancy, or are they trying to first narrow down? I mean, I guess what's the next step?
Yeah, that's a really good question. The next step is really to put this into a very large clinical trial of lots of different women from diverse backgrounds, and without knowing that, you know, that they're whether they're going to have term or not term pregnancies, all of that stuff. They really, really need to road test this and figure out if it's reliable, you know, in it for general use. If they find that, your question is a very good one. Well, would it be you'd only take one of these blood tests in, say, the middle of your pregnancy, or would you take it, you know, would you do one a month? I think all of that would have to be refined to see if there's any increase in accuracy the closer that you get to the end of your pregnancy. And they have that's one of many, many questions that they haven't figured out. But it's fascinating because it's partly the usefulness of it for, you know, something like knowing when you're going to deliver. That could avoid possibly, you know, there's a lot of C-sections that are done in this country, some of them not necessary.
Mm-hmm.
So it might be able to avoid that. It might be able to just kind of optimize the way that we use our, the way that we treat pregnant women if we know a little bit more about, you know, what their genetic material is telling us. So, and then in a sort of larger kind of sciencey way, it's really interesting.
Yeah.
because it sort of shows that there's this communication,
right,
going on between the fetus and the mother.
It makes me wonder, what else are they talking about?
Right, exactly.
Is anyone out there speculating that,
sure,
besides,
yeah,
birth date, there might be some other information?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, in fact, I think that's one of the most fascinating things. I mean, if you think about it, so one of the scientists I talked to said, you know, what they've done here is basically kind of found evidence of almost like a little bus that seems to be going back and forth, mm-hmm, carrying messages between the fetus and the mother, and stopping at the placenta, and maybe the placenta sending signals too. In fact, the placenta seemed to be sending a lot of these very relevant signals for, you know, timing. So what could that be telling you? Well, it could be telling you maybe there's a problem. Maybe the mom has some sort of health issue that is going to be having an impact on her pregnancy. And so maybe there's some kind of communication going two ways, and either the mother is having to adjust or the placenta is having to adjust in some way. Maybe there's a nutrient issue. Maybe there's an oxygen issue. There's all sorts of things that could be, you know, theoretically communicated at this cellular level that we have not really been able to understand before.
Like that could tell us why diabetes is related, you know, correlated with early, you know, premature births, why smoking is, why all those kind of things are.
Right, exactly. You could learn a lot more about the effects of those kinds of situations, those kinds of conditions. And you could also, you know, learn about ways in which either the mother or the fetus can adjust, and ways they can't. So maybe there are times where you don't have to intervene so strongly because you're monitoring this communication and you're thinking, okay, it's going to be okay. But maybe there are times where you need to really intervene. So there, it could be a real goldmine of information if they're able to, you know, continue with this and see, you know, really detect these changes in a large number of people and see that it holds up.
Pam Bellick, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Oh, sure. My pleasure.
Pam Bellick, New York Times health and science writer. She just wrote about tests. It's not ready for general use yet, but it's a blood test that could predict a pregnant woman's due date and maybe identify women who are at risk of giving birth prematurely. You can check out the link on our website at WOSU.org/all sides. We have more Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Researchers at the University of Toledo have discovered a new part of the sperm that could explain the male role in infertility. Joining us to talk about that and more is Los Angeles urologist and author of The Ultimate Guide to Male Sexual Health, Dr. Dudley Danoff. Welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you. Pleasure.
So they've discovered a new part of the sperm. This study found something that could explain the male role in infertility. What did they find?
Well, they found what we call an atypical centriole. So this is a part of the sperm. We always thought there were two of them, really one in the sperm, and as the sperm enters the zygote of the egg, there's another one. And now they discovered that there's an extra one in the sperm called the atypical centriole. And it seems that this atypical centriole, this bag of protein, is the thing that is abnormal and is the part of the sperm that explains infertility in an area that we were previously unable to explain the reason couples are infertile.
Because it's atypical means not everybody has this.
Well, I mean, the study was a small study, and they seem to think that all sperm have it.
Okay.
But they just never found it.
So why do they call it atypical? Why not just, like, centriole B?
I don't know. They call me Dudley. I don't know why they do
I guess
that.
Someone just named it, right?
I think so. I mean, I think they were very surprised to find it, and so perhaps they said, well, maybe this is an atypical one. It's not an ordinary one, but it looks like there's two of them.
Usually men are studied to death. It's kind of surprising that they didn't know something about the sperm.
Well, I think it probably has to do with a more powerful microscope, an electron microscope. You know, we look at things all day long, and then one day we see something we never saw before. And a lot of discoveries in medicine are made that way. So that's some smart dude sitting in a laboratory says, what is this? I don't recognize this. And that's the way it happens.
So it's this atypical centriole that may be carrying around a bag of proteins that may help the sperm succeed in its mission or hurt it.
Yes. And it seems that it hurts it more than it helps it.
Okay.
So if it seems to be normal, then everything is right on schedule. And if it seems to be abnormal, which is maybe why they call it atypical, it is the responsible element in unexplained infertility.
And the infertility isn't just in whether or not the sperm succeeds, but whether or not the pregnancy succeeds. It may impregnate, but the pregnancy might be weak.
You know, I think nobody really knows the mechanism
okay.
at the end of the day, but there are a lot of unexplained infertility couples that appear to be fertile. The woman is ovulating on schedule. The man's sperm numbers are good. His motility is good. His morphology, meaning the shape of the little swimmers, look good, and yet no pregnancy. So this seems to fill that missing link and explains the previously inexplicable.
Sperm counts are declining, though, in general. Do we know why?
No, but they probably have declined by about 40% over the last 10 years in American men. Nobody knows if it's the cell phone or the electronics or it's something, but But it's really a frightening statistic.
Is it just in American men, or is that just
Eastern? I mean, Eastern. You know, the developed countries, not the undeveloped countries.
Huh.
So there must be something in what we're doing, and you know, obviously, electronics have to be implicated because of the introduction of the cell phone and everybody carrying around a computer in his pocket and mm-hmm. wearing a computer on his wrist. So maybe it has something to do with that. I mean, that's the prevalent theory.
Because that's the big difference.
Right.
Hmm. Prostate cancer drug Keytruda, it's showing positive results in its first major clinical trial to test immunotherapy. What? Tell us about that. What do we know?
Well, it is a new drug. I mean, the trend today in treating urologic cancers, actually all cancers, is immunotherapy to try to make up a drug that acts as a vaccine or acts against the immune system of attacks the cell on a cellular level, just like our immune system fights a cold or fights a tumor or fights pneumonia. And Keytruda is a drug which was developed for advanced prostate cancer, and it attacks the cell, the cancer cell, on the immune level, an antibody, and it tries to destroy the cell, this particular cell. It was a small study. About 38% of the men in the study were still alive at the end of the year, and about 11% are still receiving the antibody, and only about 5% saw their tumors shrink or go away. So it's a small study. You know, these are advanced prostate cancers, previously untreatable. So this whole concept of the immune system, an antibody attacking a specific tumor cell, is where the future lies.
Hmm.
And Keytruda is an example of that.
Prostate cancer affects 1 in 9 men in the United States. Again, I mean, is that high internationally, and why so prevalent?
Yeah. Well, it is a devastating disease. It's almost the disease of aging.
Okay.
So if a man gets to be old enough, he will develop at least a focal prostate cancer. So if I went out on the street here in Los Angeles and biopsied the first 100-year-old men that I would meet randomly,
mm-hmm.
basically all of them would have a focal prostate cancer. So it's almost the process of aging. So although 1 in 9 men will be affected by prostate cancer in their lifetime, it's not going to kill them. We as urologists say we want our patients to die with prostate cancer, not of prostate cancer.
Okay.
So it's a very common disease. Younger men need aggressive treatment. The robot, older men, can be put in our watchful waiting or active surveillance group, and their cancers don't go anywhere and don't impact on their lives to any degree.
Again, there's been an increase in the number of cases of prostate cancer. Is that because we're getting better at identifying it?
I think that's the answer. A PSA, which is a blood test, a screening blood test for prostate cancer, a controversial test because other things elevate a PSA, but still the only test that we can use to identify and treat early prostate cancer, and that's when it's treatable. So in younger men, it's a devastating disease. In older men, it's just another sign of aging. And since the PSA era, which is began in the early 90s, there have been a 40% reduction in deaths from prostate cancer. So early diagnosis, effective treatment, and that's the key.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking right now about a new promising cancer drug, Keytruda, which has showed good results with prostate cancer. My guest is Dr. Dudley Danoff. He's a urologist in Los Angeles and author of The Ultimate Guide to Male Sexual Health. If you have a question about male sexual health, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Why is it such a devastating disease? I mean, you said they need aggressive treatment early. What is devastating about, I mean, obviously it's cancer, but beyond that, why so devastating?
Well, in younger men, you know, our metabolism slows as we age.
Okay.
I think it has to do with the metabolism of the tumor. So a younger man, everything is happening rapidly. The tumor is growing rapidly. It metastasizes to bone rapidly. So it's a devastating disease in younger men. As men get older, focal prostate cancer becomes less threatening. I mean, there are aberrant cases in which there are aggressive cancers in older men, but the devastating effect of these prostate cancers in younger men is the scariest.
And the PSA test, you said it's controversial because it can pick up a lot of other things and give false positives, I guess.
Well, you might say that. I probably put it another way.
Okay.
There are many things that elevate a PSA.
Gotcha.
A bowel movement, sexual activity, sitting on a hard bicycle seat, a low-grade infection. So if you do have an elevated PSA, it's very important that you consult your doctor and go over all the other variables and rule them out. But PSA is still a very, very valuable test, specifically for the early diagnosis of prostate cancer. Now, again, to your listeners, PSA is not a disease. So if somebody goes to a doctor with an elevated PSA, that doesn't mean he has anything.
Mm-hmm.
The only way we can make the diagnosis of prostate cancer is by a biopsy. But the PSA helps us to discern which, if any, of the elevated PSAs we should pursue with a biopsy.
What suggests you to do a biopsy?
Well, sometimes it's the physical examination. Sometimes it's the absence of the other things that cause PSA. No infection. We ask the repeat PSA, we abstain from sex for a few days. Don't sit on a hot bicycle seat. Try not to have a bowel movement before you come to the doctor.
Mm-hmm.
So once we've ruled out all of the other things that cause PSA to rise, then we're stuck with a biopsy.
So it's controversial, but most doctors go ahead and give it if they.
Yeah, well, it's recommended by the American Urologic Association, and I think most practicing urologists know the value of PSA. So we do it mostly once a man is 40. And we stop doing it when he's about 70 because we realize even at 70, if he develops a small prostate cancer, ultimately it's not going to impact on his life very much.
We have an email from Jonathan. He asks, what are the signs of prostate cancer? Are they obvious? Is an enlarged prostate a sign?
Okay, an enlarged prostate is not a sign. Unfortunately, prostate cancer is a silent disease until it's too late. So the signs that most people associate with prostate enlargement, frequent urination, incomplete bladder emptying, getting up at night, urinary hesitancy, dribbling, all of those are diseases related to the benign growth of the prostate, sometimes called BPH, benign prostatic hyperplasia, and have nothing whatsoever to do with prostate cancer.
So there are no signs. The only way is to do a biopsy to know for sure.
For sure. And that's what makes the PSA such a dramatic and important test.
Yeah.
Because it is, at the present time, the only way we can make the early diagnosis of prostate cancer.
Turning our sights to erectile dysfunction, a paper published Monday, and the American Heart Association found that older men with erectile dysfunction have a doubled risk of heart attack or cardiac arrest. What do you make of that?
Well, I think that as a urologist, erectile dysfunction is one of the early signs of heart disease. So if you've got clogging of the arteries that send blood to your penis, you've probably got clogging of the arteries that send blood to your heart.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's just a sign of cardiovascular illness, hyperlipidemia, perhaps diabetes. All of those things affect erections, and I think erections are just like a red flag or a flagpole.
Of sorts, yeah.
Okay,
no, we can't do the jokes.
of what's going on in the rest of the fellow.
Well, if someone comes to you and is complaining about ED,
we do a cardiovascular profile, yes.
Yeah, and yes. that usually turns
it's
up something. Yeah,
it's amazing how often we pick something up of very significance related to the circulatory system.
So those ED drugs that to improve erectile dysfunction or to eliminate it, are those safe?
Well, we have the great blue pill, which has revolutionized the whole field of ED. Mm-hmm. Viagra, we have Cialis. If your erection lasts longer than 4 hours, you know, I'd call everybody I know. But
and all of the people that use this have a beautiful wife at home.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely.
And so does the, are those drugs safe for people with heart disease?
Well, they are, with one exception. That's if you're taking nitroglycerin. So nitroglycerin is a vasodilator. In other words, it allows, it widens the blood pressure. I mean, widens the artery, mm-hmm. allow more blood in, and it has a tendency to lower the blood pressure by widening the artery. And these drugs, Viagra and Cialis, do the same thing. So if you, say, you're having vigorous sex and you call 911 with chest pain, I mean, the first thing they do is put a nitroglycerin under your tongue, and then you don't tell the paramedics that you've taken a Cialis. So it's sort of, you're doubling down, lowering the blood pressure, and can be dangerous. But that is the only circumstance that it's dangerous, because these, all of these ED drugs increase circulation. So they're actually good for the heart.
Okay. So that's kind of recalls a famous scene from that movie, Something's Gotta Give. The famous scene with, famous actor. But anyways, Dr. Dudley Danoff, thanks as always. We always appreciate your time.
And my pleasure.
Dr. Dudley Danoff, urologist in Los Angeles and author of The Ultimate Guide to Male Sexual Health. Coming up, we're going to talk about eating disorders among athletes. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. About 10 million men and twice as many women in the U.S. suffer from an eating disorder. Athletes are three times more likely than the average person, though, to fall into that category. In response, a group of female runners started the Lane 9 Project, a nonprofit aimed at educating and supporting athletes with eating disorders. Writer and women's health advocate Samantha Strong is co-founder of the Lane 9 Project. She joins us by phone from Washington. Welcome to the show, Samantha.
Hi, thanks so much.
And Heather, along with registered dietitian and co-founder of Lane 9 Project, Heather Kaplan. Welcome to the show, Heather.
Thank you, Ann.
How do you define an eating disorder, Heather?
Oh, an eating disorder is, there are a couple of them. So they are defined by what's called the DSM-5, that's a diagnostic criteria that physicians can use to diagnose someone with an eating disorder, such as anorexia, binge eating disorder, bulimia. Those are some of the better known eating disorders.
Is it a mental health issue? Is it a brain health issue?
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's considered a mental health issue. And eating disorders are actually the deadliest mental health issues.
And that's mental health versus behavioral?
Yeah, so there are obviously a lot of behavioral components to eating disorders. But for someone with that has been diagnosed with an eating disorder, they have a treatment team that consists often of a registered dietitian, a therapist, sometimes a psychiatrist, and a physician.
So what's the connection? Is it a correlation between sports and eating disorders, or is it something deeper? Samantha Strong?
Yeah, it runs the gamut, really. There are lots of facets behind it, but there is a direct connection between sport and developing an eating disorder, such as particularly for sports where image or weight is directly related to your performance, such as running, figure skating, gymnastics. And that's where you see a lot of correlations in disordered eating behaviors tied to women in sport particularly, but also men in sport as well. But the origination of and the manifestation of eating disorders is not directly attached to sport all the time, obviously. But there is a very strong connection between the two for many men and women.
And Heather, you wrote about amenorrhea. Did I pronounce that correctly?
You did, yes.
And what is it, and why is this important to know about?
Yeah, there are two forms of amenorrhea, so primary and secondary. And we're also looking at an even more specific form of amenorrhea, which is called hypothalamic amenorrhea, and it is often caused by an energy deficiency or chronically high stress levels. Usually you see both. And that is common in athletes. They actually, one study of Division II college athletes found that about a fourth of them were experiencing menstrual dysfunction. So it's a missing period for 3 or more months. And it can also be irregular periods. So this is usually caused by athletes that are under-fueling for their sport and or they're over-exercising, but usually the two go hand in hand. So they're essentially at an energy deficiency and their body doesn't have enough energy intake or food intake to support all of the systems, and therefore whatever system isn't necessary for life gets shut down. So we maintain our immune system, our cardiovascular system, our digestive system, but for sustaining life, we don't necessarily need reproduction, so that gets shut down.
And the problem with that is it can harm you long term?
Yes. So if a woman is experiencing a lack of menstrual cycles, that means that their hormones are out of balance and their estrogen levels are very low, so they are at a risk for low bone mineral density. So we actually see in some of these really young collegiate athletes, they're already developing osteopenia, which is a precursor to osteoporosis.
Wow. The brain science behind it, I know that we've learned a lot, Samantha Strong, from doing the brain scans on living and, you know, on live specimens. I mean, we can see that there's a problem with how they process food in the brain.
Mm-hmm.
How do you,
No, go ahead.
Well, I'm just wondering, do you look at things like that when you're working on your program for people with these kinds of disorders?
So, for the Lane 9 Project, we particularly work on helping and supporting specifically women in their recovery process. So no matter the stage of recovery, no matter the stage of their mental illness, whether it is a full-fledged eating disorder, disordered eating behaviors, or concerns regarding body image, we really just help foster and support health and recovery and that entire spectrum of finding yourself and finding and bettering your relationship with your body and your physicality and mental and emotional health. So we don't dive too deep into the really clinical side mm-hmm. of eating disorders as an organization. We focus much more on fostering and supporting women as they look to maximize their health from a mental, physical, and emotional perspective.
And how do you do that? What do you do?
A large part of our work is helping women take power of their own narrative and really taking charge of their stories. Eating disorder recovery can be so complex and convoluted and confusing. So we really help women through our website, lane9project.org. We have a blog, and we allow women to write and submit their own stories and narratives and really take charge of what is happening and what they're experiencing in their own lives.
And what sort
and
of...
And by doing that, we really allow women to realize that while this is a very personal and just fiercely personal journey, it is also one where they are not alone.
Why did you found Lane 9 Project, Heather Kaplan? Why did you think it was necessary above and beyond all the clinical and psychological and dietary help people are getting?
Sure. So the three of us all experienced amenorrhea at different stages of life. So, I guess most of us were in our early 20s, and Alexis and Samantha were both collegiate athletes. So they experienced that high-pressure environment of having to perform and being in these long-distance or endurance sports, and coaches and physicians not necessarily seeing their amenorrhea as an issue or not knowing or recognizing the signs and symptoms of disordered eating patterns. And so they were able to kind of fly under the radar, and both suffered injuries. And for me, going 6 years of not having a period and not having any doctors or support people in my life, supportive people in my life, really knowing what was going on or thinking that it was abnormal. And so that's what we see with a lot of these women that have reached out to us or that have heard about the project or read the stories, is that they maybe haven't had a period for a long time, whether they're in a high performance environment such as collegiate athletics, or they're just someone exercising for the enjoyment or for health or whatever their reason might be. They've been missing a period for however long, but didn't know that it's a health issue, didn't know that it's a problem, because these coaches and physicians aren't aware of it.
How could they not be aware of it? That's what they do.
You would think, yeah.
I kind of wonder how much of what you do is making them aware of it, because we know there are these relationships now. We're understanding them better and better all the time for all the wrong reasons. There's a lot of power. There's a power structure going on.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of pressure, especially in collegiate athletics, to perform within those 4 years, right? So as an athlete, you often have, hopefully 5, 10, 20 years of being able to perform at a high level and to pursue a sport that you're passionate about, whether that's for fun or for your job. But within this college athletic field, and even, you see it a little bit in high school athletics as well, there's just so much pressure for women and for men, any athlete, to really perform within those 4 years. And so it's kind of at any cost. And a lot of what we see with women, both in and outside of these high pressure performance athletic fields, is that we say at all levels of sport, we see this, is that we assume that eating a little bit healthier will make us a little bit better at our sport. And that starts as kind of an innocent goal, or, there are good intentions behind those goals to eat healthier, but often those behaviors go too far and they get really obsessive about what they're eating. There's an eating disorder called orthorexia that's not yet in the DSM-5 or that diagnostic criteria, but we see it really often.
What is that?
So many of my clients, it's defined as an unhealthy fixation with eating healthy foods. So it might be somebody who can't go to a restaurant without looking up all of the options online and making sure they can eat exactly what fits in their meal plan, or someone who has a lot of anxiety in social situations with food and prefers to have a lot of control over what they're eating and can't be very flexible. They often are thinking about food nonstop all day. They're often underfueling for what their body needs. And it's definitely a factor in a lot of these cases of amenorrhea as well.
Samantha, tell us about what you experienced and what your story was.
Yeah. So as Heather said, I was a collegiate athlete. I actually was one of the first women to participate in NCAA Women's Triathlon. And so that was very fun and exciting.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Yeah.
Thanks. Yeah. But it was also, as Heather said, a very high-pressure situation. And for me, my experience with eating disorder and amenorrhea started with running in high school and cross-country, and really kind of reached its peak in college. And since then, since I've stopped racing triathlons, I've been able to find some semblance of health and a huge move toward recovery through varying priorities and new activities such as trail running. But a lot of my own journey has actually really been coming together as of recently. Due to amenorrhea and my hormonal imbalances, my body was unable to produce the hormones I needed to really thrive and function healthfully, and I developed an autoimmune disease, Hashimoto's thyroiditis. And I have been dealing with those repercussions for the last year or so and really re-navigating my lifestyle and my health. And this is all very much related to the way I took care of my body for the last 10 years by underfueling and undernourishing.
And so I wanted to talk a little bit more about what I spoke about with Heather as far as coaches and doctors. I mean, did you talk to doctors like, I'm not getting my period? Isn't that something wrong with that? And they would, what'd they say?
Yeah, it's interesting. As an athlete in high school, it was really pretty coveted to not have your period. And
because it was less hassle, right?
Oh, less hassle, and puberty was terrifying, because as soon as a girl on the team started to develop and healthfully grow into a woman, she slowed down. And you were just scared out of your mind that that would happen to you. A huge part of our work is to take the fear out of puberty in these young girls and to remind them that it's okay and it's healthy and the best years for your sport are ahead of you. But for me in my journey, my doctors would, the most blanket statement would be to just prescribe me the birth control pill so I would have some hormones. I was diagnosed with osteoporosis in high school. So despite all of these red flags and these markers, very little was really done. But given that, it's also, I am partially at fault because I would not bring forward many of my concerns because, as I said, I didn't want to get a period.
But you were a kid.
Right?
I mean, I don't, it's hard to blame. I mean, and then I go back to both of you and say, what about the medical profession? What about the coaching profession? How are they getting educated about this?
Right.
That's one of our larger goals. Yeah.
Yeah, is to really educate and advocate doctors, physicians, trainers, coaches, parents even, on really the effects of disordered eating and amenorrhea, and really how can we educate and advocate for these girls and women to really move forward from a healthy perspective.
Who are the healthy athletes out there that you point to when you want to say, look at them, they're good, they're healthy, they're the best? Heather?
Oh, there are so many.
I know. There's a lot of them.
Yeah. We point to Lauren Fleshman a lot, who's someone who she speaks up often about these issues in sport, having gone through collegiate athletics at Stanford and going into a professional career after that. She's very passionate about women knowing that it's okay to get your period. It's okay to not conform to some of the eating standards or even body standards of your teammates. I think comparison is a huge issue amongst these athletes, assuming that everyone needs to look the same or you need to be thinner than the person next to you in order to perform better. But we also, you know, with my clients, something I run into a lot is as they're working through recovery, if they're a runner or whatever sport they might be, they tend to fall into that trap of comparing themselves and their body type to professional runners. But I actually try not to harp on that too much because they might see a professional runner and think, well, if they can be that lean or that muscular, why can't I be that lean and that muscular and still get my period? The difference being this is that person's job and they're focusing on this 24 hours a day, fueling and training and resting. And this is something that most of the people that I'm working with are doing for fun. You know, running is just something that they enjoy.
Hmm. Yeah. And Samantha Strong, you're still dealing with the issues related to this, but otherwise you're both healthy?
Yeah. Yeah. We are. Heather actually is a new mom.
Congratulations.
So, thank you. But yeah, we are healthy and happy and really excited to be helping this community by sharing our own experiences and stories and helping women share theirs as well.
Well, we'll have a link to the Lane 9 Project on our website at WOSU.org/allsides for everybody out there who wants to learn more about it. For now, I have to thank you guys both for joining us. Samantha Strong, co-founder of Lane 9 Project and a writer for Women's Health and a writer for Women's Health Advocate. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And also registered dietitian and co-founder of Lane 9 Project, Heather Kaplan. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Anne. It was a pleasure.
That's it for Wellness Wednesday today. Thank you so much for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.